My name is Roger Harms, and I am an obstetrician in Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm presenting this lecture this morning on high-tech birth, or the hows and whys of test tube babies. I'm supposed to say that so that everybody knows if they're in the wrong lecture to get out quick. I'm presenting this with my objective being pretty much informational, and maybe tee off a few questions in your mind that are related to our lives as Christians and questions that come to mind as we address variables that develop as we look at in vitro fertilization in general. And that's the first thing that I want to mention. The term test tube babies is really a rather poor one because it paints a picture of a little human being in a glass jar that's floating around there. And that's, of course, not what we're talking about. Even though, you know, these test tube baby in vitro fertilization clinics are popping up all over America, and the competition is getting maybe a little bit more keen for patients. And so there was an ad in the paper the other day, you know, in the classifieds asking for patients for this program, and it said, womb with a view. That was sort of misleading. What we're talking about, really, the only part that's done in glass is the fertilization process. I don't recognize too many faces, but I gave a course last week on embryology. And during the first day of that, we discussed what happens at fertilization and the initial development of the embryo. And what we talked about in the first day last week in the embryology course is what's being done in the laboratory. Of course, after the very initial stages of cell division, the embryo goes back in the mother. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The first thing I want to talk about this morning is the whys. Why do we have in vitro fertilization programs at all? Okay. But I skipped one thing. That big long word, in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer, is really the name for this procedure. In vitro is medical linguistics for something, so no one will understand that what it means is you're doing it in the laboratory. Okay, in vivo would be inside human beings in its natural site. In vitro means in a laboratory setting. So that's what that word means. Fertilization, of course, simply is referring to the process of sperm meeting egg. That's what happens in the petri dish. And then after that turns into an embryo, you do embryo transfer back into the mother. So the full term for what you're talking about is in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer. Now, getting into the whys. Well, this does have something to do with our life as Christians and sympathizing with our fellow Christians who have a problem. Of all couples in the United States, after 1 year of attempting pregnancy, 20% of them will not be pregnant. And after about 2 years of attempting pregnancy, 10%. And that's the real rate of infertility, is about 10% of all couples will be infertile. Now, think of how many couples you know. That's an awful lot of people. An awful lot of people who want children and can't have children, and thus this becomes a major problem for me to face in my practice, and is one that is the subject of many people's thoughts and affects couples profoundly, both in their marriage dynamics, in their day-to-day living, and oftentimes every month is taken as a mini grief, as Granger would tell us about in the study of good grief and bad grief that we've also been discussing these weeks. So, let's look at those patients who are infertile. Why are they infertile? So we're talking about 10% of American couples are infertile. Of that group, this is an interesting fact related to the struggle for women's rights. Infertility has traditionally been considered a female problem. Thus, an obstetrician gynecologist like me is considered to be an expert in infertility. But 50% of infertility is male factor. No less. It's at least 50%. Okay, well, what factors do you have to have from the point of view of the male? Another reason why males have been ignored, it sort of feeds itself. We don't understand male factor infertility nearly as well as we understand female infertility because it hasn't been studied nearly as enough or as much as women have. But the obvious one is no sperm at all in a sperm sample. That's at least one you can't argue about. None at all. Okay? Then you can say with pretty good confidence that male is the factor. Okay. The other problem is sperm are present but in lower numbers than normal. What's normal? Amazing numbers. 80 to 120 million sperm in every cc of seminal fluid is a normal count. That's a lot of sperm. Okay? Now, I say that's normal. But the problem is that people that go into laboratories or go into their doctor's office and try to produce a sample generally are not doing something that's normal. And counts in the laboratory tend not to be that good. Okay? So we would consider, generally speaking, if other factors are okay, if you have 40 million, you're probably okay. Between about 20 and 40 million is a gray area. We don't know what to make of that. If that's as good as that male partner can ever do, then that's probably a problem. But semen analyses vary considerably at different samples, so one sample that's low does not mean that a male has a problem. You have to check it again and again and again, which makes us rather unpopular. Okay. Less than 20 million, once again, that's pretty much considered true oligospermia. Oligo is, again, fancy medical term meaning too few. Okay? So, these are the people that can maybe be helped by in vitro fertilization, as we'll get to. When we talk about these normal counts, that means that in the normal setting, when a baby is about to be produced, there's about 300 to 500 million sperm placed at the starting line to get up and fertilize an egg, okay, placed at the cervix in the vagina. Only about 30 to 40 will make it into the fallopian tube where the egg is. So you're talking about 300 to 500 million work their way down to 30 to 40. So if you cut down that number considerably, the attrition rate makes it so very likely none are going to make it all the way up into the fallopian tube to do the job of fertilization. However, if you do this where you have no distance to travel in a petri dish, or you can put the 20 million sperm right next to the egg, they've got a better chance. So that's where in vitro fertilization comes in regard to male factor infertility. Okay.
Can I ask a question right
here? Sure.
Well, I thought part of survival of the fittest would start right there at the sperm making it up to the egg. Are we in danger, if we're doing it in the petri dish, of using some weak or not as strong sperm? What's the deal there?
Well, that is a reasonably good question. The question was, using Darwin as the model, that maybe you need to have strong, healthy, vigorous sperm to do the job, or else you get a substandard embryo. And maybe we will be selecting poorer embryos by giving the sperm such a head start at putting them in the petri dish. All I can say is at this point, we don't know. Okay? There are other things that we measure about male factor infertility, though. Not only numbers, but how fast they swim. How many of them are swimming? And indeed, if you have 20 million sperm, a low count, but they look to be healthy in every way, shape, or form, it makes you feel a little better about that. But the answer to that question is not in. Okay. Moving on. So the first question you ask is, are there sperm available? Infertility starts out easy. The second question is, are there eggs available? Okay, that's a simple question. Is ovulation happening in the female partner? Okay. This is probably the second biggest category of infertility, ovulation failure. And people may be having periods regularly or irregularly and not be ovulating. But most people who aren't ovulating also aren't having periods or not having them very often. And so you get a real hint on this just when you're taking your history from the patient. If a woman has regular, normal periods that she can predict it's going to happen, chances are very good that she's ovulating. If not, then ovulation problems may be what we're dealing with. Okay. It's beyond the scope of this talk to talk about all the things that might give rise to ovulation failure, except to say, when we've discovered that somebody is not making eggs, not ovulating, generally speaking, there are some things we can do about it. Medications, the so-called fertility drugs, are specifically designed to make women ovulate. The most common of these is clomiphene citrate. Its brand name that's most commonly used is Clomid, which I'll talk about because that's how everybody practically refers to it. The way Clomid works is like putting ice cubes on your thermostat, okay? What would happen in your furnace in the wintertime if you put ice cubes around the thermostat all the time? It would run like crazy, okay? Well, what the Clomid does is the brain has a thermostat too. It's an estrogen stat, okay? It reads how much estrogen is running around in a woman's body, and if it is inadequate, more stimulation is passed on to the ovary to produce more of this estrogen. And the estrogen is really just a byproduct of the making of eggs, and therefore more eggs are produced as a result. Okay, so what Clomid does is like puts ice cubes on that. It makes it not able, makes the thermostat not able to recognize estrogen floating around in the body, and puts out 2, 3, 4, 5 times as much stimulation to the ovaries as would normally occur. Oftentimes, ovulation results from this treatment. If it doesn't work, then you use, I mentioned, the stimulating agents that come from the brain, the pituitary gland more specifically. If Clomid doesn't work, then you override the system and give lots and lots of those stimulating agents. Where do we get those? From menopausal women. Menopausal women whose ovaries are not producing eggs, their brains and pituitary glands are working fine. So they have lots of this stimulating agent trying to tell their ovaries to make eggs, but there aren't any eggs there to be made. So there's a lot of it running around. So we can isolate that from postmenopausal women, and it's human menopausal gonadotropin is what that's called. And you can give that to women and drive their ovaries to get to be the size of basketballs if you aren't careful, because it's a very potent medication. Okay. I mention this because this is the stuff we will use when we get down to in vitro fertilization to make numerous eggs come to maturity in a given month.
I have a question. How do you get that from a menopausal woman?
Urine.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Okay. All righty. Now, the third major factor of infertility is so-called tubal factors. And this is kind of a wastebasket term, if you will, for anything that mechanically prevents the act of fertilization happen. Okay? Mechanically prevents it. The most common thing is flat-out closure of the fallopian tubes. Okay? Now, for anybody that, if we don't have the anatomy of the female internal genitalia in mind, I am a horrible artist, but the uterus is a pear-shaped structure with a central cavity. And fallopian tubes come from each corner of the triangular part of the pear, if you will. One's a lot longer than the other, isn't it? The ovaries, that's not the way it really is. Okay, the ovaries sit like that. Okay. Now, if you have occlusion of the fallopian tubes, obviously eggs are not going to be able to be picked up by the tube and carried down into the uterus, and the converse is true. Sperm are not going to be able to get upstream to fertilize the egg. One of the problems that are existing is that this condition is on a rampage of increasing and increasing and increasing as a result of the marked increase in venereal diseases that started in about the late 60s, 70s, and hasn't really slowed down too much yet. But the price of all that, the wages of sin may not be death, it's probably infertility. Because the price of those venereal diseases is occlusion of the fallopian tubes. That's not the only thing that blocks tubes, but it is the most common thing that blocks tubes. Okay, now if the far end of the tubes are blocked out, the tubes tend to dilate and get big, and that's the worst problem you can have, because that destroys the lining cells of the tube, and it won't, even if you get the mechanical conduit open, it won't, the cells are no longer functional to nourish the egg on its way down. If you have blockage right next to the uterus here, then the damage to the length of the tube is usually a lot less, and the success rate for fixing this is improved considerably. And only way to fix it is by surgery, major operations. Okay. You can have tubal factor infertility without having blocked tubes. You can have adhesions kind of encasing the ovaries, like you put it in a baggie. Adhesions are scar tissue, usually the same kind of causes. Gonorrhea is most common, chlamydial infections. And this saran wrap around the ovary prevents the eggs from escaping and getting into the fallopian tube, even if the tube looks perfectly normal. That too would require major surgery to fix. Okay. Now, one other major cause I should mention before we get away, move on to the subject matter, is endometriosis. Once again, remember all these things only constitute together 50% of infertility. All the things I've been mentioning here are all female factors. Put them all together, they only constitute 50% of infertility. Okay, endometriosis. Big word. The endometrium is the tissue that lines the uterus. Osis means it's somewhere where it shouldn't be, okay? And that's exactly what it is. The lining of the uterus is growing somewhere other than inside the uterus. And the most common places for it to grow is on the ovaries, around the fallopian tubes, and the tissue that lines the abdomen in the immediate vicinity of the uterus. The problem, every time a woman has a menstrual period, the lining of the uterus bleeds, so does this stuff. It bleeds inside the abdomen, gives scar tissue, causes pain, and the body is always working in high gear to get rid of all this garbage that's produced every month by this bleeding that's going on inside the abdomen. And one theory is, at least, that those garbage collector cells will gobble up sperm on their way up also, because they're sort of overturned on. Okay? At any rate, although we don't understand it very well, endometriosis is a fairly common cause of infertility, and it appears to be on at least a somewhat mechanical basis. It somehow inhibits the mechanical act of sperm and egg getting together rather than preventing eggs being produced or preventing fertility.
How do you treat that?
It's a difficult problem, and you have to weigh it according to the age of the patient, her desire for childbearing, because a patient might come to you with pain and not really be interested in children at the time, so you treat it differently. There's two basic approaches. If you make the ovaries quit producing estrogen, this tissue is related to the hormones just like the lining of the uterus is. So if you get rid of all the stimulating hormones, the estrogen, it will go away. There are medications that prevent the secretion of estrogen from the ovaries and produce what we call a pseudomenopause. And that medication is called danazol. And it's quite effective at making this stuff go away. But it takes 6 to 9 months. And as you might imagine, if it's turning the ovaries off, you certainly can't get pregnant while you're taking danazol. So it is something that you'd only want to use if a patient was willing to wait 6 to 9 months to try again at getting pregnant. And it also, of course, doesn't remove any scar tissue or adhesions that might have formed with the endometriosis, so that when infertility is the primary reason you're treating endometriosis, usually, but not always, you turn to surgery. And then when surgery is over, at that point, with all the endometriosis cleaned up, etc., it should be the best time for a patient to get pregnant, because you've done nothing to prevent it from coming back. Okay. So, now, there's a whole raft of other, I hate to say less important, but less frequent and less certain causes of infertility, okay? Cervical factors, perhaps the cervical mucus is not good, so the sperm cannot penetrate into the uterus. Allergy, there really are people who are allergic to their husband's sperm, and that's a problem, obviously, but pretty rare. And then there's a whole bunch of people, especially you end up seeming with me, who have unexplained infertility, which means you've gone through everything. You've gone through all the tests, you've looked at all these factors, and they seem to be normal, and yet we end up with roughly about 20% of all infertile patients, no explanation. Okay, everything seems to be fine, but we haven't got an answer. Okay, well, for those answers that we do have, looking at the male factor again, if the sperm count is low and the male comes in for a physical exam and is found to have varicose veins around in the scrotum, etc., sometimes that can be improved with surgery by removing those varicose veins. More often than not, however, with its male factor problem, the only easy answer is to get another male factor, which is usually artificial insemination by donor. Now, this opens a bit of a can of worms for us, because this is a common practice today. I would wager to say there's no major city in the United States that doesn't have an artificial insemination program ongoing. Nobody is really overseeing this very much, though, and as there are more and more babies that result from a fairly small population of donors, it is conceivable that a son and daughter of this donor could one time meet and once you get married, and there'd be no way to know that they were half-brother and half-sister. Now, that's probably pretty far-fetched, but as we get more and more and more into tampering with things, those kind of problems increase. I wouldn't say we should strike out artificial insemination programs on that basis, but just something to be aware of and be thinking about. Okay, we talked about ovulation failure, we treat with medications, we talked about tubal factor and endometriosis that's primarily treated with surgery. Now we get to the next step. Particularly patients with tubal factor and endometriosis can have surgery, and because surgery obviously leaves scar tissue too, the only thing you can do is hope to improve the situation, okay? But the odds really aren't that good. If you've got plug tubes and you're in the most favorable population, the ones that had closure of the tube right next to the uterus, for example, we may be talking about 60% chance that that patient will get pregnant after surgery. That's with no adhesions or anything else. If the patient has adhesions as well as their tubes being closed, we got to drop it below 50%, maybe in the 40% range if the closure is there. If you have closure of the fallopian tubes at the far end, as I talked about initially with the widening, the dilatation of the fallopian tubes, then the chances are only about 5 to 10% of successful bearing children, even after surgical repair. So, obviously, we have a large group of patients who fail surgical repair of their problem. And there's no doubt about it. Everybody that studied it, second crack surgeries just aren't worth doing. The results are so poor. Endometriosis is another thing that if infertility persists despite endometriosis surgery, the endometriosis can grow back and we've got the problem again. Once again, second time surgery for endometriosis is not very useful. Ovulation failure, if we can't get people to ovulate, we're probably not going to be able to solve their problems by any other means. But a lot of people who present to you with ovulation failure, you turn out after you've looked at them for a while, that they have other problems too. You get them to ovulate, and then later on they find out now you've got them ovulating, but they have another problem. So that some of these patients end up being failures also. So what I'm getting down to is that we have a large population for whom we don't have an answer. I should throw in all those unexplaineds, you know, those 10 to 20% of people who come and see a doctor about infertility who will eventually end up being unexplained infertility. All those people are looking for an answer too. So somebody, particularly in the light of tubal problems, the fallopian tubes are so bashed up, they're so messed up that there's no way any kind of surgical treatment is going to help them. And yet their ovaries are working, their uterus is working, there's no reason these people couldn't get pregnant if you can bypass the stage of the fallopian tube. This was the initial thought of Edwards and Steptoe in England when they first started doing in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer. And what they did initially was that they would monitor a woman's natural menstrual cycle very carefully and watch her temperature chart and her blood estrogens. And by that way, they were able to anticipate when she was going to ovulate. Then when they got within about 48 hours of the time when they expected her to ovulate, they'd start checking blood tests about every 2 hours, looking for one of those pituitary hormones that I mentioned that would tell them, this is it, she's about to ovulate. And then they'd quick take her back to the operating room and do a procedure called a laparoscopy. Okay? A laparoscopy is a minor surgical procedure in which a telescope-like instrument is placed inside the abdomen, usually right around the belly button, and the uterus, tubes, and ovaries can then be viewed. They'd make a second little incision just above the pubic hairline and put a pencil-sized instrument in through there. With that instrument, they could grasp the ovary and hold it in one place. And then they pass a needle through the abdomen, a third instrument in, that they could, let me back up and just say when an egg is about to pop out of the ovary, the nest that the egg is sitting in is called a follicle. And the nest is sort of a misuse of the term, but it's a nice way to think about it. The cells that are cushioning and holding the egg inside the ovary are called the follicle. And they produce fluid, and that egg is actually sitting in the fluid. The fluid gets to be greater and greater in volume until, at the time of ovulation, it's about one, the whole follicle, the nest, is about 1.5 centimeters in diameter, maybe even up to 2. So we're almost getting up to 3/4 of an inch in terms of diameter. So you can see it easily with your naked eye. If you're looking at an ovary that's about to ovulate, you can see this bulge in the wall of the ovary that it's clear-walled, and that's where the egg is going to come out. The egg itself is pinhead size or a little smaller and can be aspirated along with the fluid inside that follicle. So a needle is passed into that little sack of water, and along with the fluid, you hope to pull out the egg. It sounds simple, but you've got to get it. You can't spill it inside the abdomen and ever hope to find it again. And the other thing is, the little egg is very sensitive to its environment. It cannot be exposed to a different partial pressure of gases. It cannot be exposed to any bacteria. It's a very, very sensitive little structure, and you cannot abuse it. So it has to be aspirated directly into a closed system, maintained with a special partial pressure of oxygen over it, and in an exceedingly sterile environment in order to keep this thing alive. Well, Edwards and Steptoe tried this for quite a while, something like 4 or 5 years before they ever had anybody who got pregnant from the process. But then they had a few pregnancies. Let me back up a little bit, we're getting ahead of myself, and say that they tried to follow natural cycles, okay? So they would be running in at 2 o'clock in the morning when a woman was about to ovulate to aspirate these eggs, and they'd only get one at a time. Then they would use the husband's sperm, mix it in a petri dish, place it in a special medium, place it in a 98.6 degree incubator, and watch and wait and see what would happen. And lo and behold, fertilization did happen. The sperm met the egg started to divide, and they started to get nervous. Okay? How long can we wait? You know, we can't pretend to think that we're going to keep this thing alive outside the body very long, but we don't know the optimum time. As you recall, any of you that were in the embryology course, 5 to 7 days after ovulation is when the embryo reaches the uterus, lands there, and starts to implant. Well, they didn't want to wait any 5 to 7 days. So when they had a cell, the cells were dividing, and they got it up to about the 8-cell stage, they placed it back inside the uterus simply by going through the vagina and placing it inside the uterus through the normal opening in the cervix, and sat back, made the patient lay down for a long time, 24 hours. Hopefully, gravity might help. Actually, there's very little science to help to show that, but just as well not have gravity working against you. And so they put the patient in bed rest for about 24 hours, and then they couldn't do much except to say, well, let's wait and see. And that's what they did. They wait and saw. And as you recall, the little baby, who must be 4 or 5 now, Elizabeth Brown, was born by this process and was the first baby ever born by in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer.
And that was their first attempt?
Oh, no. It wasn't their first attempt by a long shot. And they had some ectopic pregnancies, and they had some pregnancies that ended in miscarriages along the way before they got a baby out of it. Okay? Well, needless to say, the excitement in everybody's heart was there, and it's certainly in the people who work in this area, the possibility of a new, very impressive tool to bypass tubal factor infertility. And people wanted to start doing it like crazy, and many, many, many people got into it. And soon the Australians, who, I guess I shouldn't really put it this way, but they've not tended to look at the ethical questions a whole lot. They tended to just forge ahead from the scientific point of view and ask questions later. And they really did make progress in terms of in vitro fertilization. And the folks in Melbourne right away said, this is silly. If we get one egg to work with and you get only about 30% fertilization rate of egg, meat, and sperm, well, if we had 6 or 7, the chances that we got fertilized eggs would increase considerably. So they started giving their patients that human menopausal gonadotropin, HMG, and drive their ovaries to make lots of eggs. Somewhere 3 in 20 eggs at one shot, okay? Now, you can't do that to people and not harvest the eggs. Matter of fact, people will get deathly ill if you drive their ovaries like that and don't aspirate the fluid out of the ovaries. So once you've launched into this, you're sort of committed to the laparoscopy along the way. At any rate, they started doing this, and as you would expect, they would get numerous eggs available at laparoscopy. And commonly we have baseball-size ovaries that we're working with. with numerous little bumps on them, each about an inch or so in diameter, that you can aspirate to get eggs from. And as a result, you start harvesting numerous eggs, mixing the millions of sperm from the husband with them, and you get numerous embryos. Okay. So now there was another puzzle. If we put back four or five embryos, are we going to get quadruplets or quintuplets? Well, they scratched their head for a while and said, you know, nobody's all that good at it. They've just got one in England, and now they've got another one in utero on the way, and they've been working at it a long time. It looks like they're doing about maybe 10 to 15% of their efforts turn out to be a pregnancy. So, you know, there must be something working against us here. Why don't we just put them all back in and see what happens? Well, that turned out to be safe for a couple years. As this process was getting, and I would hardly call it perfected, as it was evolving, okay, initially putting back four or five embryos in the first year and a half or so, nobody reported any multiple births at all. What births they had was singleton births, but the success rate was going up. And the success rate was getting into the 20% range per attempt. Every time this attempt occurs, though, the woman has to go through the stimulation of her ovaries, a laparoscopy, aspiration of the ovaries, so that's an attempt. And we were getting up to maybe 20% of those attempts ending up in a pregnancy. Okay, that's not a baby, that's a pregnancy. Okay, now, so it was encouraging. It was going up in terms of success, and they weren't getting multiple births. So as the more and more in vitro fertilization clinics opened around the world, and especially in America, most everybody didn't want to tackle the moral question of selecting which embryos go back in, or what the optimum number might be of embryos that go back in. So let's just solve the problem by putting them all back in. And that's what was done. Unfortunately, as I talk to you today, information in the literature is beginning to show that this isn't going to turn out so good. If you look at a graph of number of embryos transferred versus living babies, it starts out something like this. Am I doing this right? No, I want to turn it the other way around. Living babies up here, and number of embryos down here. It plateaus, and then starts to drop off. Well, what happens? Well, out here, we're starting to get fours and fives and threes, triplets, quadruplets, quintuplets, and in an obstetrical point of view, triplets and quadruplets and quintuplets are a nightmare. At triplets, you've got about a 50% chance, at best, of getting living babies out of that. It drops off radically as you go to quadruplets and quintuplets because they just are not, the uterus was not meant to hold that many children. It doesn't hold them long enough. You have premature labor problems, and the babies are born before they have a chance at viability. So as far as living babies, when you get into the fours and fives, the chances of that being successful was pretty poor. Well, the top of the curve appears to be three today as we talk. Three embryos going back in is the most likely to give you just one child, but not yet very likely to give you three, four, and five. We'll accept twins. Twins have a fairly good outcome, although poorer than a singleton. Okay, so with the success of this program, people started to apply it to other people with infertility problems. Not only those with tubal factor problems, but people with endometriosis, people who had male factor problems, their husbands had low sperm counts, not zero, but low, with the presumption that it would work in the petri dish when it can't work inside the body. And finally, patients that have unexplained infertility. For no known reason, they have infertility. And so the numbers of patients that are entering this kind of program is increasing considerably. And I would have to say that it is a technique that is probably with us. Okay. Well, pros and cons. Just give me a chance to turn it over. On pros and cons, just from an objective point of view, the couple who is considering doing this has to consider that, first of all, they're going to have to give up an awful lot of time. The female of the couple is going to have to spend about 10 days to 2 weeks at whatever location this is being done, and during that time have repeated blood tests and repeated ultrasound examinations of their ovaries to know when the egg is ready. They eventually go to a laparoscopy, which will, although minor surgery, you know, it's still surgery, and then go to embryo transfer, which will be another hospitalization. And so roughly the entire first half of her cycle, from the time that her period's over until ovulation, until a few days after ovulation when the embryos are ready to put back, she'll be tied down in the city wherever this is. Okay. The second, I'd say practical, for lack of a better term, problem is that although the Australians are up to about 28% to 29% success per cycle, they are the very best in the world. And practically any place in the United States that we're talking about this, you'd still have to be realistic and say it's about 20% per effort. So you put in all that time, you get a 20% chance of having a pregnancy. And third, cost. No insurance company is paying for this as yet, and it's roughly $5,000 per try. Okay. So, needless to say, you would think that there wouldn't be many people going in for this. But I'm surprised how many people will save their shekels. And to tell you the truth, in a way, I'm not surprised. I mean, we throw $10,000 away on a new car without thinking twice about it these days. People who are wanting babies don't think a whole lot, really, of $5,000 for a chance to have a child. And so it's people are finding the money. Okay. However, as you can see along the way, and as we talked about this, there are potentials here for uses. The obvious use that it was designed for was to give patients who could in no other way have a child a chance to have a child. I certainly believe honestly that that's what the procedure is for, that's what it was designed for, and it was designed out of benevolence. There was no intent to do anything different. However, now that we are in this area of technology where you can have an embryo in a petri dish dividing, it starts to enter the mind, certainly the mind of patients who come to you about, well, can we do anything special, such as, can we select, is it a boy or a girl? And only put back the male embryos, for example. Well, the technology is here. That can be done. Nobody is doing it, but this procedure has been done in animals for a long time in veterinary medicine, and sex selection is obviously a very important thing to a dairy farmer, for example. And so sex selection was a long time ago figured out on how to do this. And so the technology is available. The other thing is the technology is available to divide the embryo when it's just a pile of cells and make identical twins, which some people have thought about trying. The third thing is, how about instead of, nobody wants to throw away embryos, nobody feels good about that, but three seems to be the optimum number. What do we do Still, if you harvest 6 or 7 eggs, you can't be sure you're going to get more than 3 embryos out of that because they may not all fertilize. So what do we do when we get 6 or 7 eggs and 5 of them fertilize, and yet the optimum to put back is 3? After that, the chances of this lady having a living baby from the process actually decreases. Now what do we do? What do you do with the 2 extra? And which 3 do you put back in? This all starts entering into the question of judgments that we don't have any way of measuring, really. But one thing the Australians have done was, it has been done again in veterinary medicine for a long time, is freeze the extra embryos. This is offered as an option there anyway. One argument for why we aren't doing better than 20 to 30% is that the cycle is so abnormal that you're producing 6 to 8 eggs in, that probably the environment inside the uterus is somehow abnormal, getting faced with all that hormone load during the... So wouldn't it be smarter to put the babies back in another cycle when the hormonal environment, the hormonal milieu, is closer to normal? So some people have said, let's freeze them for one cycle and put them back on a normal cycle and see if that will increase the chances. Okay? Again, the technology was available in terms of veterinary medicine to freeze embryos, and there has now been a baby born in Australia who was briefly frozen in its early life. Okay. The other possibilities, of course, is that you could have frozen embryo banks for donation, like we have artificial insemination sperm banks. You could, if you were about to undergo some kind of operation where you might lose your ovaries, or we're undergoing chemotherapy where you'd probably lose all your follicles, or radiation treatment that would probably wipe out your ovaries, could you donate a few embryos to hold in reserve in case you survived whatever this was and would like to have more children? All these are not beyond the realm of our technology within the next 10 years. And the questions that arise in terms of the ethical issues will be something that I hope we get into Thursday night's forum, but we can get into it a little bit now if you'd like. Dee, you had a question.
Do you know anything about problems?
All I've heard so far was a case report in a journal that stated an apparently normal baby was born by all measures of normalcy that you can see in the first few weeks of life. That doesn't test the normalcy very well, but it's certainly more encouraging than having a gross anomaly, too.
I was wondering if you could get into something like selling your eggs. You know, like if you have, you finished your childbearing, but you've been very fertile and you have good eggs being produced yet.
That would presumably be possible. And there is a market for it, because there are... There could be a black market for it, but there is a population of women who have premature ovarian failure, which essentially means menopause at an early age. It's not caused by the natural functions that occur at menopause, but it has the same result. There are no eggs in the ovaries. At this point, there's no way we know that that person can have a baby, but they have a uterus that will function normally when treated with hormones, and so presumably could be the recipient of an ovum donation. An ovum donation is by no means far from happening. As a matter of fact, it is probably going to happen in the next year or two. Now, whereas a man who makes a donation usually gets paid $25 to $50 or so for a semen sample, I would presume that the rate will be a little higher if you have to undergo laparoscopy to give your eggs to somebody. But probably that will happen.
Has there been any attempt to see how it would develop outside the uterus?
Beyond? Not with human beings that I'm aware of. Okay, not that has been published with human embryos. But with in veterinary science, they do have a limitation of how far they've been able to go outside the uterus. And essentially, nobody has been able to come up with something that a placenta could implant into and get us beyond the time of implantation. Once the embryo is ready to implant in the uterus, it either is going to have to implant in something that has a blood supply, or it isn't going to make it. And what the veterinary scientists have done sometimes is put the embryo inside other species, such as
I've seen that.
Zebras and horses and other things like that. The potential again exists for extra human incubator for some of these, though we don't know if that would work.
It'd be nice to have the baby and not have to go through the 9 months pregnancy.
Think how easy the labor would be for a cat. Yes. Well, that's a good question. Whether or not Clomid actually causes ectopic pregnancies is debatable, because you're so often working with a subfertile group, and not to the credit of all physicians, many people have a patient who comes in and says, I've been infertile, and they say, oh, here's some Clomid, you know, and that's about how far it goes. And so you overdrive that patient's system, and even though she has tubal factor infertility, you make her super fertile with all these eggs running around, and one of them gets lodged in that rotten fallopian tube. That can't be proved. Neither can the converse. There is definitely a higher rate of ectopic pregnancies in patients who take Clomid, but whether it's related to Clomid or not, it's hard to know. Certainly, the motility, the muscle action of the fallopian tube, how that works, we don't understand. It's never been able to be observed in human beings. And so what affects its motility, we don't understand. And certainly Clomid, because it's an anti-estrogen, may affect the muscle action of the fallopian tube and lead to ectopic pregnancies. Preventing it, since we don't know how it's caused, we don't have a way of preventing ectopics specifically in that case or in any other case. That's a chance to take.
But do they have to be careful about blood types and all that so the body won't reject the embryo, or is there that kind of connection?
Well, there are certain blood types that you'd have to be careful about, yes. But there's no particular selection as man meets woman, and the baby is obviously going to have a blood type depending on that mix. And although it can have the same blood type as the mother, it's never going to be precisely the same blood type.
Well, I mean to transplant to a...
Oh, well, in that case, not necessarily either. Let's say if you are type O blood type and your husband is AB, you would carry a type A baby or a type B baby. You couldn't have a baby that's type O, so they're all different than you. And that can give some minor problems, but not major ones as far as rejection of the baby. Rh problems are something that we can work around, but you would probably not choose to transfer an Rh positive embryo into an Rh negative mother. That would not be very smart if you had the choices.
Right.
Yeah.
She's had a robot after the first pregnancy, or if she hasn't been pregnant.
If she hasn't been pregnant, their likelihood of there being a problem is pretty small. But there's still, even with Rogam as we use it today, about a 1.7% chance that the mother will become sensitized for her next pregnancy. For those of you who aren't familiar with Rh disease and Rogam, that's another lecture in itself, but essentially there is an injection that can prevent problems related to Rh blood type differences between the baby and the mother. But I think that's enough of explanation on that for the moment, unless other people have questions afterwards. How do they make estrogen that they give you? Premarin is the most common estrogen prescribed. It is a natural conglomerate of estrogens that come from horse's urine. Okay? Now, the other estrogens that are available, such as in birth control pills, ethinyl estradiol, biochemists have sat down in the laboratory and mixed together different chemicals that came out to look kind of like an estrogen, and lo and behold, if you give it to people, it behaves kind of like an estrogen. And they have manufactured that chemical. It did not exist in a normal state. And so you can't have synthetic estrogens. The classic is diethylstilbestrol. The most common one today is ethinyl estradiol, which is in almost all birth control pills. But the most common to be used in the postmenopausal type of estrogen replacement therapy is natural estrogens from horse's urine. Okay.
Pregnant horses, isn't it?
Pregnant horses, yes, I think it is, to get a higher concentration. D again. Today we do not. As far as gene splicing and things like that, we haven't really gotten beyond mice and more commonly bacteria, because bacteria have the potential for medical industry. The one that has come into play and is a very important one is that E. coli have now been trained, if you will, by putting the right sequence of genes in their chromosomes that they can make insulin. So that the days when insulin had to be harvested from the pancreas of cows and pigs is probably going to be passed, because these E. coli, these bacteria, make insulin precisely like human insulin, whereas cow insulin and pig insulin is a little bit different. It works, but it's a little bit different. The E. coli can make human insulin. So in bacteria is where it's been used the most. It's been used experimentally in mice and rats, but nobody has attempted anything that fine with human beings. But to say 15 years from now we won't be, I think would be a little bit dumb to say that. Yes? Is infertility hereditary? It struck me, and the first time I ever heard it, it's kind of a funny question, because how can you inherit infertility? And yet it really is. If your mother had trouble getting pregnant, particularly if you had ovulation dysfunction and had to take Clomid to get pregnant, you do have a higher chance to be in the same basket. Okay? Well, it depends on when she lost. The question was whether habitual abortion or frequent miscarriages is hereditary. And maybe, but weakly so. We have very poor understandings of what causes repetitive miscarriages, or at least 40% of them. And so not knowing the factor, it's hard to know for sure. But it's not a very strongly inherited trait. Yes?
Do you have an opinion on whether birth control pills have lent itself toward infertility in any way?
In one way, they certainly have. And then that's that people have tended to defer their family until later. And it's definitely true that both in males and females, fertility peaks in the early 20s. Doesn't drop to nothing by any means, but you will have a larger population of infertile people at age 30 to 35 than you do between 20 and 25. And so to the extent that birth control pills defer the attempt at conceiving children, it has increased the population of people who are infertile and increased their desperation somewhat, because if they started at age 30, they're not willing to wait as long until the baby comes along. But as far as being actually a causal factor, it does not appear to be a causal factor in infertility, except for the temporary. Some people don't have periods for 3 months, 6 months, even a year after stopping the pill. And that's, of course, a year of involuntary infertility. But that's not a long-term problem. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your attention. And maybe you'll be thinking about some of these issues for our forum on Thursday night.